Well, good morning, everyone, and welcome to RTE 2, Module 11. Hope you've all had a good week. We've only got a small group on, but let's do the quiz anyway, and we can let Kerry in on it too, if you like. Okay, so which of the following is a file management command that will display information about any file system that is mounted on a Linux system? Is it A, show file, B, make file, C, df, or D, du? Yeah, look at them go. C is correct, df. Okay, what configuration file is used by the line printer daemon LPD? Is it the etc. lpconfig, that's A, B, the etc. lpcfg, C, the etc. lpc, or D, the etc. printcat? And for those that said D, you are correct, the etc. printcat.
Which is interesting because the file name for configuring your terminals used to be historically be etc. termcap before we all went to terminfo. So you had etc. termcap and you had etc. printcap.
And I have a feeling, and correct me if I'm wrong, the printcap question is in one of the tests.
It is in the test.
Yes, it is. Okay, now this is a nice interesting one. Which command line interface, I think we'll do it as a yes-no, can open a Telnet connection to a remote computer? Is it A, telnet space candy.company.com, yes or no? That's one answer.
There's two
yes,
answers.
Yes, yeah, good.
Well.
Oh, I didn't hear you, sorry. Okay, yes, so that's correct. How about this one? Connect space candy.company.com. That's also correct. All right. Now,
I think there
the
are
next
that
one
are
is... There's two.
Right.
So we want yes, no still. Connect, space, 204.45.55.90.
Might be kill the web server time missing.
What's getting at.
Now this one, telnet, space, 204.45.55.90.
Assuming that's the correct IP address for said host, yes.
Look at them all go. That's good. Okay. Now, the next one I think we'll also do as a yes-no, just because it makes it a little bit easier. Which two directories most commonly contain the sysv scripts that can be used to start, restart, or stop a Linux daemon? Okay, so yes-no answers. The etc. init.d. That is a yes. Yep. The etc. rcd init.d.
We have these different commands in the newer version of Fedora now, which is much easier to remember.
Yeah, this is the old one. Actually, that's a no.
Etc. rc.d init.d.
rc. No, there was something different there. Say that again, Kerry.
Etc. init.d rc.d. What have they got there?
Etc. rcd. init.d. Not dot .d, just D, init.d.
Ah, right, okay, that is a no. Sorry, I missed one of the dots.
That's okay. The next one, etc. rc init. Yes, no. And then, yes, that's correct, it is a no. And the next one, etc. rc dot .d. init.d.
Yes.
Ah, good one. Yeah. Okay, next question. Which of the following applies to scripts? A, the code is compiled into an executable file. B, the user interaction plays a key role. C, the code is the code is executed from top to bottom. Or D, the code is more complex than standard programs. And the correct answer is C, the code is executed from top
from
to bottom.
From top to bottom, yep.
Mm.
At least that's why I write my script.
Which command displays the name of the user who is currently logged onto the system? Is it A, user, B, logon, C, terminal, or D, who am I? Yeah, look at them all go. Yeah, good.
You can also type who mom likes, and it'll tell you as well. Did you know that, Elise?
What's that? Who mum likes? Okay.
Yeah, if you go to the query, go who space mom space likes, it'll actually show you who's logged in. It's actually an extension to the who command.
Yeah, I'm familiar with the who command. I often use it. I think, who's logged in on this system right now?
Who mom likes will do the same as who am I.
Oh, okay, gotcha. Very good. Does it come back and say me?
Okay, what is the name of the common text editor used in Linux? Is it A, star, B, shadow, C, write, or D, VI?
Yes, common but not well liked.
Yes, VI.
And so the recording you aren't getting the answers is VI, VI editor, which comes with every distribution.
It is actually well liked, it's just not well liked by the general user population. I know hacker types that swear by it, as opposed to swearing at it.
There are people who swear by it and those who swear at it, yes. I think I'm on the latter.
There's VI on the Mac as well, it's a standard to even the OS X shell environment as well.
Yeah, because I think it's really more standard to Unix, isn't it? So not, it's just a Linux being a derivative catches it as well.
It's on just about every Unix system in existence. So you can always depend on VI, which you'll probably need to use to hack the configuration files to get yourself Nano.
Yeah.
But interestingly enough, and this is sort of old history, but I don't know whether anybody remembers that the Telnet in Windows 95 was actually buggy. And the terminal emulation was broken, so if you fired up anything full screen like VI, it would all go to pieces. So it was interesting to know that that was certainly a problem, and you needed to be able to tidy up those problems. I actually fixed Windows Telnet as part of OSR2, and it tends to behave itself fairly well now.
Otherwise it falls to pieces. Which of the following run levels can be used to shut down or halt a Linux system? Is it A, 0, B, 1, C, 3, or D, 5?
Now it's not 3 and 5.
And now for the $1 million level.
It's A for anyone on the recording. Yep, let's get $1 million. You watch that show
I'd
too,
I'd phone
right?
a friend, but I'm out of credit.
Yeah. They dropped that. You can't do that anymore.
Can't you? Oh, I haven't watched it for a long time.
The new one they got on, you're sort of like on your own.
Apparently, I heard a story on one of the news stories where somebody actually went and bashed their friend senseless when their friend gave them the wrong answer and they didn't...
Oh, my God!
Oh, no!
It's great, eh? Okay, no, what is a popular really GUI stuff. Used by Linux? Is it A, X-Window, B, Pico, C, Vi, or D, Desktop Manager?
Yeah.
And we have to split the $1 million between the three.
Split it three ways. It's, for the recording people, it's... What was A? Genome.
X-Window.
X-Window.
Oh, X-Window, sorry, X-Window, yeah. Oh. I sort of had my finger on the key waiting for the other three answers to come back. X-Window is there, which is very nice.
And now for the $1.25 million question. Ooh. Oh, the pressure's on. Which of the following Linux commands provides information about other commands? And if you don't get this right, you go to the bottom of the class and you lose $1.25 million. Is it A, IS, is it B, search, is it C, man, is it D, list, or is it E, define?
We will win!
Yay!
It's C, man. Man space command.
It is C, man. Yeah, well done. Okay, now we're all broke. The house is cleaned out, we better get on with the lesson. Okay, that was well done, everybody. Okay, now today we're talking about all sorts of things on the network server. How to do backups, how to map network drives, how to optimize your system, and all that sort of cool stuff. It's quite a long lesson, so I'll be doing a bit of skimming because there's a number of things on commands to use. And as usual, I think when we've got a lot of things on commands, I can give you some of the most common usable ones, but you still need to go and read for yourself too. And a lot of things may certainly be not as up to date in this lecture as what we would hope for, but is what you will need in your exams. So, okay, Kieran, I might just get you. Could you turn that radio off, please? It's a bit distracting. That's all. Oh, that's all right. Okay, sorry, we're just turning the radio off in the background. Thank you, that's better. So, all right, talking about backup methods. So when you're a system administrator, you're going to be doing lots of backups. So we're going to be talking all about the different types of backups. Why do you think you need to back up information?
In case something goes horribly wrong.
When something goes horribly wrong, not in
case. Yeah, that's probably... Yeah. Well, Grace has been more optimistic. Yeah. One of those sayings, if it can go wrong, it will. It usually does with computers, doesn't it, at some stage. Okay, so you need to have the ability to restore data. So you want to be doing backups so that if you need case arises, you're going to... be okay, not going to be crying. And particularly so if you're an administrator of a network, because if you haven't got good backups, and it's surprising, I'll just relay a little story here. A number of years ago, I worked in Melbourne, at least, as you know. And I was working in Melbourne, and I worked in the city in Carlton. And the business I worked with had about 17, 18 employees, and one of the people there destroyed the database and there was no backup. So it was rather, as you can imagine. So backups are really, really important. And some of the things that would come into consideration when you're doing backups, for one would be, the cost of doing them or the cost of not doing them. You know, the external storage is not all that expensive these days, and I guess it's coming down all the time in costs, and the really costs shouldn't come into it now. But also you might want to look at the storage capacity of your external media that you want to use to ensure that you're able to manage all of the data that you need to back up. You also need to be doing it in a way that's, you're not spending all day doing system backups, that you're able to do it in a reliable and, effective way for your organisations. So there's a number of ways in which we can do that, and the administrator can use a backup tape in a tape drive. You can use a number of other external media as well. You can do a number of different types of backups. We have full backups, partial backups, incremental and differential backups. And I'll just go a little bit into what they all mean. So a full backup, as it sounds, you're backing up everything that's on the hard drive. Okay, generally you'd be, if you're the administrator, you'd be getting that to be scheduled in so that it's doing it every day. And when you're performing a full backup, every file mark is cleared and marked as being backup. And by doing a full backup or normal backup, you're speeding up also the restore process. Partial backup, as it sounds, you've got selected files, okay, and so your backup will back up the files and folders that you select, and so it's another type of backup that you can use. You will, by the way, get questions on this in your final. There is one on the different types of backups. With an incremental backup, what that means is that only the files that have actually changed since you did the last backup are going to be backed up. Okay, so if they haven't been changed, they won't be backed up at that stage. And a differential backup, and what that does is it backs up the files that you've created or changed since the last normal or actual incremental backup. Now, it doesn't actually mark the files as having been backed up, and it won't clear the markers. So, but all the files, even those that haven't been changed since the last backup, will get backed up in a differential backup. Any questions on that just before we move on? All hunky-dory? Good. Okay. All right, now drive mapping is something that you would also need to do as an administrator, and what that does is it allows you to share the resources that are on your server. And it's a two-stage process, and it needs that you or requires that you have defined a path and then assign a drive letter to that path. So so when we're doing, say, a network drive in a Windows network operating system, you can do it by using Windows Explorer, or you can also do it by using the net use command. So in Explorer, you would go to the folder on the remote system, and you'd do that by going to your start, network, neighborhood, server name, and then your shared folder name. Or alternatively, you can do it through the tools menu, and then you would choose the option with you where you actually map the network drive. Okay. Well, now if you're using the net use command, we're talking about can be used instead of mapping the drives through Explorer, so you can actually incorporate it into a logon script, and that automatically runs when each of the users logs on to the network. Now, when you're using or mapping a drive in Linux, you can use the SAMR daemon, and what happens, it loads the SMB protocol, and that allows communication actually between Linux and Windows. And once your SAMR daemon's been loaded, and it allows, you've configured it to, and you've configured the directories so that you've selected sharing, then the Windows clients can actually map a drive to the shared directory on the Linux server.
Should I point out at this point that this is in the practical assessment for this course?
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's in the practical assessment, and as I pointed out to the canary in the practical assessment, my business would be lost without it. So there you go, it's very important, Sandra, if it's configured and working properly.
Okay, now I'm going to read what I've got here, but I would suggest that you go and reread these notes, because there's a lot of commands in this, and ways to do things that are actually listed in the notes, so I would refer you to go and have a reread and reread and actually play around with your virtual machine.
And if you have problems with it, email the discuss list. There's plenty of people on that list who know about Samba. Me included, I'll give you a hand.
Now, if you're a client computer, you would actually have to use the mount command so that you could get a connection to the shared directory on the server. And that would, the command you'd use is mount, and then you'd use your server name. Then you'd have your directory, your subdirectory, and your local directory. And the actual local directory points to the remote share that's denoted by the first part of the command. And we refer to that as the directory mount point. Just a point there, the mount point location needs to already exist before you can actually map to it. Okay, now also wanted to talk about the management of partitions and the way the file systems are stored in the partitions. So there's the main tools in a Linux system that are used to manage disk partitions are the FDisk, MKFS and FSCK utilities.
This is in the final.
I'm just going to talk a little bit about them. It certainly is. Okay, so we have talked about FDIS before, I believe it was about Chapter 7, but we sort of didn't go into it in a lot of detail. Now, in Linux, there's a version of FDIS that operates differently from the version that's actually in Windows and other systems like DOS. It's text-based, and uses one of the letter commands to enable you to manipulate the various options. And with FDISC, you can actually get a list of the commands by typing M or question mark at the FDISC prompt. Okay. So the FDISC command is used along with the file name that's associated with the partition. Okay, once you've used the command, it's a good idea to use the letter P option, and that will display information that is regarding the partition that you've got. Okay, so again, make sure before you do all these things that you're back up first, because if your partition is deleted, so will all your data be. So, you know, it's all fine and dandy to have partitions on your drive, but you need to make sure that everything is backed up. Okay, now with MKFS, okay, so when we create a new partition or make changes to the partition, that's the first step in the partition management. So once you've got changes that have been made, you need to set up a file system on the partition, and we also talk about that as formatting the partition. So to make a file system in Linux, we would use the MKFS utility. Okay, and in the notes you'll find that the there is a whole lot on using MKFS. So once you've actually put your command in using MKFS, the formatting will start, and it depends on the size of the partition that you're creating, on the amount of time that will take, and once that's complete, then once it's all formatted, your partition is ready and it's ready to store all your data. Okay, now the FSCK command is used to check the file system and also to repair any damaged files. And if, for example, you turned off your system and you had a problem with your file structure, you can then use the FSCK command to try and repair your system.
I was going to say the word there is try. The repair may not necessarily succeed. So whenever possible, try to shut down your Linux machines cleanly. And especially if you are doing mission-critical stuff, try and put them on a UPS. I personally have mine on a UPS because XFS does not handle ungraceful shutdown very well.
Okay, now the other thing is, if you find that FSCK has made changes to your file system, you need to reboot your system. And what that'll do is allow Linux to reread your information about your file system and also prevents further corruption of the systems. Now with EXT3, XFS or Riser FS, they don't actually perform file system checks during startup. So even if the system, you know, hadn't been shut down properly. So they use actually a journaling system, and that journaling system keeps a log of all what's been performed and has all the information about what's been done. So and the process actually happens automatically or by default every time your file system gets mounted. Okay, now there is a whole lot of commands in their notes there about the FDIS commands. Just a couple of them: D deletes a partition, N creates a new partition. P prints or displays the partition layout. And there's some more there, and also on the MKFS command.
Probably Q to quit is probably an important one too. Just in case you can't get it.
Yep. We do have a whole lot of commands that are in there, so please go to your notes and have a read and get familiar with them. But better still, have a play with your virtual machines. So you are reinforcing it by practically doing things as well. Because we could sit and go through the notes till the cows come home, but you'll never remember it until you start doing it. Unless you've got a photographic memory, which not too many of us have. Be nice, wouldn't it? Okay, cron jobs. So cron programs actually allow us to run tasks or schedule tasks at intervals on your Linux system. We refer to them as cron programs or cron jobs, and they allow us to schedule system maintenance so that they get performed in an automatic way. And cron is actually controlled by the entries in the var spool cron and the etc.cron.d directories, and also in the etc.cron tab file. And what it does is it executes commands based on whether or not there's an entry that's specified in those files to do so. So it's not really a command, but rather a daemon, and it runs constantly in the background, something like FTP or HTTP server. So it's constantly running in the background, scanning the system and looking for events that might enable it. And it works slightly different from other daemons in that it runs once every minute, scans the three previously mentioned configuration files, and then it performs any of the tasks that are specified in those configuration files. The first of the two types of cron jobs are that you can actually schedule are the system cron jobs. So they're the jobs that obviously surrounding your system maintenance, and so they're keeping things ticking along and running smoothly, hopefully. Okay, and that would include things like your cleaning out your temporary directory. You know, another example, I guess, would be the system cron is log rotation, and what log rotation does is it changes the names of the log files, and then it deletes the old log files in a routine way, so the files don't get too large for the hard drive. The second type of cron jobs are called user cron jobs, and they can be created by your users, as it sounds, and it allows them to run specific functions or programs that they need to do. Now, with regard to system cron jobs, they can only be run by the root user, and as an administrator, you may find it's good to run a user cron job as root so that you can run a task during a time that's specified by you. System cron jobs actually tend to be fairly rigid in the time frame that they are scheduled to run, whereas user cron jobs can be actually run in a more flexible way. Any questions up to that point?
Cron's one of those things that runs in the background, and it's very, very important. And if for some reason you break it or whatever, your system will come to pieces on you when the disks fill up with logs and stuff. So it's one of those sort of tricky things that it's handy to know of its existence and be ready to look it up when you need to mess with it, because it also does things like emptying the mail queues. It also does things like checking security permissions. If you've got Debian, there's a check security script that runs. And it also is responsible for updating your multi-router traffic graphs if you've in fact set those up to graph the usage over time of your internet link on your modem, etc.
Now, your system cron job's actually controlled in the etc. cron tab file, and it's that file contains sort of the parameters for your cron jobs, things like your path of the job, and the other lines in the file specify things like the minute, the hour of the day, day of the week that you want that cron job to run. And just bear in mind there that the time values that entered using a 24-hour clock, and there will be asterisks in that file, so they indicate the possible values of any variables you wish to make. Now, another variable in the file is the account name, and that's the account name that you're going to use to run that particular program. Okay. So when you're actually creating a user cron job created using the cron tab utility, okay, now just bear in mind there that don't confuse that with the etc. cron tab file. It's actually, they are two different things. With the cron tab utility, it's a command and it's entered at the prompt. So you'd have, for example, cron tab, then your user, and then you'd build that up to your file. So it can be used with or without the user parameter, but if you're using it with that command, then a user cron job would be created for your specific user. If you're not using a user in that parameter, then the user cron job would be created for the current user. So I guess it's good practice there to always use the user parameter so that you're actually specifying the user for which the cron job's going to be created. Okay, with also what you can use with Linux is the at command, and it's similar to using cron. And what it does is it takes a list of commands that you've typed at the shell interface, or that's saved in a file, and then runs them at a specified time that's set by the command. So the scheduling commands are going to be useful for you as an administrator, have set up and running so that it's all running fairly smoothly and automatically for you. I'm just scrolling down here because there's a whole lot of commands there. Okay, now, just as a point here, with cron jobs, if you are using, there are a number of, again, commands with format and action, and I would refer you to your notes to have a look at them because these are very important, but more so actually go and play with them. Okay. Now, another important aspect of managing your Linux system is how to deal with any crashes that you might have with your software. When you have a software crash, they generate error files, and that information lists any of your potential causes. And they're stored in a core file that gets created, and that core file is referred to as the core dump. Okay, so it's really important to understand what core dumps can, what information they can provide you with, and also how to manage them. So once the errors have been identified, then you can go ahead and hopefully replace or repair.
I love the music.
I said hopefully. Sorry?
Why am I hearing a basic drum beat in the background of you?
Oh, I don't know. Must be the rhythm of my heart. Keeps beating like a drum.
We're doing Cavi the music. You know, it'd be like, live on Cavi.
Well, we haven't had any music singing for a while, have we?
Live on Cavi tonight. You'll learn about Linux.
So that's the rhythm of my heart. Keeps beating like a drum. Oh, Geraldine, get over it. Well, this is very dry stuff, isn't it? You know, when you're actually going through it.
Keep it going, we've just mixed that in. Keep it going, we don't mind. I just wondered if it was coming out of the recording, that's all.
It's all right, all of the students have just walked out of the room. That's one way to get rid of them, I'll keep singing. Okay, now, so the purpose of your core dump is to allow programmers to have a look at the file and to figure out what's the problem. So if you didn't have a core dump, you wouldn't be able to go back and look at the at what's actually caused your crash. So it's very, very handy. And if you're a programmer, you can have a look at the debugging code and trace back through the steps and find out what's actually led to the crash. So the size of your core dump is going to depend on the size of the program that actually produced it. And if you've got a large program and it's used a lot of your resources, it's going to make a large core dump file. Obviously, if you've got a smaller one, you're going to have a smaller core dump file. In either case, though, you're going to have a file created in the same directory in which the program that crashed is located. Okay, and your syntax for using the size of, or for limiting the size of core files, which you can use, is ulimit space minus c size. So the actual size parameter there is specified in kilobytes, and then you can make sure that, none of your core files will be created in larger than the specified file. So that's very handy. Okay, now if you're looking at locating and deleting core files, you would need to have access to your root account. So of course, if you haven't got that, you wouldn't be able to access all of the directories which are in those files. Sorry, I'm just scrolling down.
The only reason...
There's lots of...
The only reason they...
We always do that, don't we?
Yeah, we do. The only reason they mention the core files and stuff is because when you have large programs that crash, you can get quite a sizable core dump and it can chew up a lot of disk space. So they do tend to mention that. It's a bit like the crash dumps in Windows. If you have crash dumping turned on and you don't set it to 64K small memory dump, you will actually burn up a lot of disk space with crash dumps.
Just a word of caution there too. If you're... you know, have a think about it before you actually delete or move any of your core files. Of course, there might be core files or directories that aren't actually the particular files that you're looking for. And if you delete one of those files, you can make other files or other programs not work. So you sort of need to know what you're doing there.
Just at this point, sorry for interrupting everyone. I must away.
No?
I've got to meet these people I've been working with now for 2 years. It's amazing how you work with somebody in the same city as yourself and not even met them. And they've invited me out for lunch. So we are going to go to Docklands.
Well, very nice.
Lunch at a Cambodian restaurant, I do believe.
Sounds good.
So we're off for lunch. And if I might ask Kerry, can you just make sure the lectures are up today so I can tweet about them? It's something I wanted to check in yesterday's lecture, if that's all right. This afternoon, when you get a moment. And I shall love you and leave you and see you all next week.
Okay, Elise.
And I'll do what I can.
Yeah, I appreciate your effort. Thank you, Kerry. Okay, chat soon.
Okay, now, another thing you need to know as the administrator is what are critical and non-critical processes. And when we think about Linux system, it's a multi-user and also a multitasking system, which we've talked about before. And, you know, you can have multiple users logged on into the system at any one time. Okay, so, all right. Now, when you've got processes launched in Linux, yep.
Sorry, the music appears to be coming from this Flash-driven website that's behind me. My apologies, it's not coming from Cavi. It's coming from the website. Once I close the intro,
fair enough.
I wonder what the hell's going on here. So there it is. My apologies.
So, Elise, it wasn't the rhythm of my heart.
No, my dear, it wasn't.
Oh, dear.
Sorry.
Okay.
Next time, better luck. It's this flash-driven website that's very difficult for a vision-impaired person to navigate, I might add, but it does have a map of where this place is on it. So I'm just here to apologise. So my apologies, and I'll catch you next week.
Okay, no worries. So in Linux, it launches... See you, Leon. I think it's down to the three of us now, then.
Pretty much.
launched in a Linux system from the shell, and the shell launches the program from there. And we refer to that as the parent process and the child process. So the original process is your parent, and any processes after that are the parent and child processes. Okay. With the processes that you've got running on Linux, they can be viewed by using the PS command. And that's one of the most important commands that you, when you're working as an administrator, will need to know when you're managing a Linux server system. As with a lot of the Linux commands that we've talked about in the course, the PS command can have a variety of options that allows you to manipulate what you want as your final output. For example, the PS command output, you have commands such as PS, say for example A, then space forest, and the information displayed gives you, what am I trying to say there?
Gives you a tree of processes.
A tree, thank you. Yes. Thinking the forest and the trees, but it couldn't come out. another one that's useful is the top command, TOP, similar to your PS command. So, and it functions much like your performance tool in Windows, so it gives you detailed information about the type of CPU and RAM usage that's happening. Okay, and things that would tell you how many users you've got currently logged onto the system, how much memory, all those type of things. Okay, sometimes you can get processes that actually lock up on your system, and it can then start using all of your system resources, so it starts to run very slowly. So if that happens to you, the really useful command there is the kill command, and it's like ending processes in Windows, but in Linux you use the kill command, and that will free things up for you. So that is a useful one to remember. One of the other things you need to do, obviously, as an administrator of a Linux system, is to assign permissions. I know we've talked about this before, but we're just going to go into it again, but in a little bit more detail. So typically, your programs have the same types of permission and can read the same files as the user who runs a particular program. But sometimes you might want to have additional permissions by different users. That's commonly done in most businesses these days. You'll have the upper echelon that'll have permission to use, you know, A, B, C, D, E, F, G. Then you'll have another one down from that, and those users will be able to use A, B, C, D. And then you might have coming down further down the pecking order, you might have some users that are only able to use A and B, and so on. Okay. We did talk a little bit about the set user ID, or the SUID, and it's used with executable files on Linux. And what that does is it's used by the operating system to run programs with the permissions that have been set. So the set group ID, as I said, we touched on that before too, works in much the same way, but it allows programs to be run by a group. So those permissions are useful, but also come with a few security risks. If you are allowing people to execute programs, that's one risk. If you're assigning permissions to a group, you've got to be very sensitive to any security or to an individual, you know, security issues that may come with that. So you've got to be trusting the people that you're allowing to assign those or to use those permissions. Okay. Anything you want to say there, Kerry, while I'm scrolling down?
No, that's all pretty good and covers it fairly well as far as I can tell. You'll get a lot more practice by actually tampering with the virtual machines and...
Absolutely.
Where's Peter today?
He's probably taken a holiday.
Fair enough.
I think we gave him the option, didn't we, seeing it is school holidays here. Okay, also another thing an administrator needs to be aware of is disk management. Okay, so you've got to make sure that you've got enough resources available to the end users. You've got to make sure that everything's running hunky-dory, and you've got to be managing your disk. So some of the things you might want to be doing is regularly defragmenting and managing, making sure you've got enough free space on your disk. Okay, so you can actually perform your management in a number of ways. You would be regularly looking at the status of the disk and making adjustments, or you can do it automatically so that you get notifications on when your, for example, when your disk space falls below a level that you've actually predetermined. And that's really quite a useful thing to do. You can set quotas for user accounts. Now, where we work at Curtin, we have quotas each month, and when we're getting close to using up our quota, we get an email saying, hey, you've just about used it all up. So it allows them to have a ceiling on how much each individual can store on the network. And how much they can download, all those type of things you can put specifications on. Another resource that you have to manage as an administrator is your amount of RAM. I'm not going to ask questions here because I was going to say, can anyone tell me what RAM stands for? But we all know it's random access memory. Yeah, we've only got... couple of people left now, so I won't pick on people.
Actually, we've got you've got three of us here. You've got you, me, and Alex.
And I'm here.
Oh, and Grace. Yes. Okay, so whenever you have applications running on your computer, you have information that's read from your hard drive, and it's placed into a temporary storage, which we refer to as the RAM. And what the computer does, it uses that portion of the RAM to enable it to execute the programs and frees up the space once the program exits. Okay. If you've got a lack of RAM or a lack of available RAM, your performance on your network's going to be slowed down. So that's important, because actually RAM is actually limited in its resources. But as an administrator, you might be able to compensate for the lack of memory through the use of virtual memory. And what that virtual memory does is allocate space on hard drive, treats it as an extension of the system RAM. Another thing that you have to consider as administrator is the amount of CPU usage. Okay, so we know that the CPU stands for the central processing unit, and it's like your brains or of your computer. So that everything that's actually used by the operating system, including the network operating system, is processed. And it's done that in millions of times per second, and it does that automatically. So for every application that you've got running on your computer, that's applications that are actually visible to you or not visible to you, they are running or using CPU cycles. Sometimes you can have the CPU being overloaded when you've got lots of things happening simultaneously. And we've all had that happen to us where you get like a system actually locks up or freezes. Yes. As an administrator, you're going to be making sure or that you've got enough CPU available or strong, powerful enough CPU, I should say, to ensure that things are running smoothly and that's not happening. All right, now also as the administrator, you want to be reviewing your daily logs. And that's a way that you can actually keep a review of what's happening on your network operating system. And they can be reviewed for a number of things. You might want to be looking at when you had malfunctions happening or if you've had anyone trying to hack into the system. So your logs or your log files actually get automatically generated by the system, and it's a text statement and it gives you information about events that have occurred. Just as an example, then most of your web servers have a log file, and in that file it'll detail every information request that's been made to the server. For example, you might have the time the requests were made, who actually made it, like the IP address of the remote computer, and actually what files they tried to access as well. Just as a point there, in Windows 2000, you have the computer management tool, and that allows the users to browse all the logged events that are generated by the network operating system. And there's two categories, and they're beneath the system tools heading, and they're the event view and your performance logs and alerts. So, and that will give you the types of logged events that are recorded there. You would actually get that information by double clicking on any of those entries too. Now, most operating systems have a means of automatically writing to a system log file, and that file details, as I said, all of the device failures, any attempts of communication, and any other errors that are there. So, very important thing to be able to know how to get to your log files and how to understand and read what has actually been occurring. When you're viewing logs on Linux system, it's done differently in Linux than it is in Windows. Linux uses log daemons, and it uses them to control any events that are entered in the system log. So the first step in being able to view log files in Linux is to be able to locate them, obviously. So most of the Linux system log files are located in the var log directory, and they're located and maintained by the system log daemon or syslog, and also in the kernel log daemon or klog. And they are configured, both those daemons are configured using the syslog.conf file. A number of the servers, for example, on your Linux system, and we'll say for example their Samba, maintain their own log files, and they are stored and can be configured with the server native configuration file. In Samba, that is smb.conf, and that's where your log files are located. There are a number of log files in Linux, and as an administrator, you know, unless you're experienced, it can be difficult to know which are the important ones and which ones need attention. And you know, most of your log files won't need you to be looking at them, but you may, when you're actually at a level of being an administrator, you may get a lot of valuable information in those log files. It's good to know how to do it. Okay, now there's a number also, when you're thinking, say for example you're on a Linux server, you can get very large log files, and that makes things a little bit difficult. So there are some tools that you can use that will actually help you manage the system log files and also make analyzing those files easier. And we talked about earlier about the cron jobs, and how they can be used to rename old log files. And they do that so that new ones can be created, old ones deleted on a regular basis, and that keeps the log files from growing to unmanageable sizes. So your log file rotation can be set to occur either daily, weekly, monthly, and that's dependent on, you know, the amount of activity you've got on your system. And if you've got a very active system, you know, you've you know, may find that you're wanting to rotate them more frequently. So you have also a file analysis tool that can be used, which is called LogCheck, and some of the distributions of Linux include that by default, and it makes things easier to configure. So if you had a system that or a distribution that didn't have LogCheck, you'd need to configure it to run on the system. Okay, so you'd actually need to add it. After LogCheck's been configured, you get a cron job needs to be created, and that will schedule the intervals at which that LogCheck is actually run. Now, just as switching from Linux there, but if you wanted to, say, for example, check your resource usage in Windows, either, say, for example, XP or 2000, you have, well, in 2000 XP, both have the performance tool. And you can get to that using the Start menu, then your Programs, System Administration Performance option. And you would then come to a menu tree. And it presents you with the system monitor, and also the performance logs and alerts are there. And also you can use the system monitor. It actually displays an empty graph by default, and you can then right-click on the graph and select Add Counters, and that will specify which system resources to monitor in the graph. Okay, so that's very useful to know as well. Another way you can configure the display, you can right-click on the graph and select the properties. So once you've got that properties dialog box, you can then select alternate views. For example, you might want to select a text-only report. It's also customizable there, so you can actually have it updating automatically and checking that checkbox if you wish to. Now, with regard to Linux, when you're checking on usage on Linux, there's text-based commands that you can enter at the command line. And there are a number of things that you can do, for example, to get the details of the various parameters that you're using in commands. You can view the respective man page, that's, you know, there's something you're going to be doing more and more on as you go on with using Linux. Okay, the df command is used to display the amount of disk space. If you can't remember that, you can check your man page. And it's when you use that command, you have the output of it is organized into actually six columns. So those six columns have your file system, your blocks, the use space, the available capacity, and that type of thing. So you have each file system listed on each an individual line, and then it gives you all the information about the system. Another way to look at your system resources, if you want to track it further, is the du command. And that will tell you the exact location of any problems that you've got. And we touched on the top command before, that's another really informative command. And it functions much like the Windows, you know, performance tool. And you'll have, gives you number of, say, for example, the number of users that are currently logged on, again, the amount of available memory, and how much your CPU is using as far as resources. Okay, now, obviously, if you're working as an administrator, it sounds like a really good job, but it can be a really, really high-pressure job as well. When things are running smoothly, administrators get no credit. When they're not, everybody's after their throat, aren't they, Kerry?
Yes,
you know, they're looking for, yes. So, you know, you've got to be making sure that, you know, you've got a plan for managing your network and making sure that you're actually, you know, looking or preempting any problems that may happen. Okay, now there are about three concepts that you have to understand when you're analysing or optimising your network performance, and we're going to talk a little bit about these now. For example, when you're analysing network performance, and I'll just say here, this is in your test. We're going to talk about bottlenecks, baselines, and best practices. And it's in your test. Okay, so a bottleneck is exactly what the name implies. It's a point in the system where you have a limiting of data throughput. And by that, what I mean is the amount of data that can actually flow through your network. A bit like a bottleneck on the road, people refer to blockage as a bottleneck when things slow down or stop, indeed.
It's a bit like a bottleneck on the beer when you can't drink the beer fast enough because of the narrow neck of the beer bottle.
That's it. So you can have a bottleneck that's caused with a component on your network or limitations of your network or limitations of a component. And you know, that's an important one, and I do remember that back in your test. So hopefully you're going to try and preempt any bottlenecks by making sure that everything's running in the best and smoothest possible way. And that might be by, you may have to preempt that by upgrading your resources, replacing some of your components to make sure you're getting the best performance. Okay. And good planning can help you avoid having bottlenecks. Now, just on performance there, primary performance monitoring tool for safe Windows 2000 servers is referred to actually as performance. And performance can actually monitor all your hardware and software that's on your server. And you can actually do that by creating real-time chart of your resource utilization, or you can actually do it by your log files and analyzing them. The same thing in Unix or Linux can be used to monitor your performance. The tools are the SAR, VMstat, IOSTAT, and PS. And we'll talk a little bit about those. What happens is there's flags that are used by those commands, and they can vary depending on the different versions of Unix or Linux that you're running. And again, you would use the Linux man command to get the specifics about the commands that you need to run. The Unix or Linux System Activity Reporter, or SAR, System Activity Reporter, that command collects and reports all your activity, and it'll tell you all about what the processor's utilizing, how much your buffer's utilizing, and so forth. The Linux or Unix Virtual Memory Statistics, or VMstat, gives you information about the virtual memory that's on your system server. And the IOSTAT, which I touched on before, gives you information about your disk subsystem and the input-output on your server. And the other one was the PS command, and that lists all the processes that are running on your server. Okay. Now,
how much more we got?
I'm just having a look. Let me just check. If you talk about processor bottlenecks a little bit more, and I'll go down and check, because it's very heavy today.
Processor bottlenecks are where you run out of processor cycles to be able to perform tasks. Therefore, if you have too many things running on the server at once and you run out of CPU, you can actually have the server performance degrade. This can often be fixed by either building a multiple processor system, installing a faster processor, or by installing a multiple core processor or a multiple core processor at a high processor rate. So, look at your top command, look at your CPU usage. If you're running out of CPU usage, upgrade your processor.
We've got heaps left, so we might actually... I think we will, and I think we'll probably leave it where we are, because what's related there is getting onto a lot of other things, and I think that's probably a good spot to leave it. So without any further ado, we'll call this Part A, so ITE Module 11 Part A, and we'll come back next week with Part B of Module 11. These are quite deep, and I think it's a very good idea to break it up a little bit. Okay, so we'll say arrivederci, and we'll talk more about those commands and also about bottlenecks and things like that next week. So, adios amigos. Talk to you soon.
Okay.